Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. Before we have the Zetas address this, I'd like to give a bit of background on life on other worlds. We on Earth tend to think of aliens as hominoid, like ourselves, but with some slight difference. For instance, on Star Trek, a more wrinkled forehead or a larger ear, but basically like ourselves. But this is hardly the reality out there in the universe, according to the Zetas. And I quote from Zeta Talk, percentages. If one were to take a census on intelligent life in the part of the universe the Earth goes round in, the results would probably shock humans. On a world-by-world basis, there are about 1,000 dead worlds for every one that holds life. Humans are familiar enough with their surroundings to understand conditions on other planets, and if anything, would be surprised at the percentages capable of life. Not every life-bearing planet sustains life that can develop to the level required for conscious and intelligent thought. There are about 2,500 primordial worlds for everyone that can support an intelligent species. Your Earth, for instance, had many such species with this potential. Of those worlds that hold intelligent species, the vast majority, perhaps 75%, are water babies, as the vast majority of habitable planets are essentially water planets. These species may be crab-like, fish-like, squid-like, or formed like almost any of your ocean inhabitants, an almost infinite variety. Of the worlds that sustain land-dwelling intelligent species, the greater share, just under 60%, are reptilian. Reptilian life forms appear first and thus better their percentages. A minority are mammalian, above 10%. But whenever these life forms are a candidate, they beat out all other candidates, as mammalian existence is highly interactive and thus a good spiritual schoolyard. The remaining land-dwelling species range between bird-like or insect types, the latter more prevalent at about 30%. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Percentages, written December 15, 1995. The overall percentages, then, are 1 in 1,000 planets can sustain life. Of those planets, 1 in 2,500 life-bearing planets evolve intelligent species. Of those planets, 75% are water babies, 15% are reptilian, 2.5% are hominoid, 7.5% are bird-like, with a very tiny percentage insect-like. Well, not all worlds may be habitable, but many that we on Earth have assumed incapable of sustaining life do, in fact, sustain life. This is from Zeta Talk, Habitable Worlds. Life only evolves where something akin to DNA can develop and be nurtured, where the physical processes are essentially explosive, as within suns, or immobilized, as on your frozen outer planets, any DNA-type structure would either be torn apart or fail to grow. What kind of thought process could a single atom maintain? Habitable worlds are, 1, those that are not undergoing an essentially explosive process, such as suns undergo, or not in such close proximity to such a process that they share the same environment. 2, those that are not so far from a heat and light generating process that their atoms are essentially immobilized. There is more variety in these types of worlds than mankind currently surmises. As long as a DNA-type structure can form and not be destroyed, life can exist. However, such slow-motion worlds are poor schoolhouses, and souls fail to spark in such a boring environment. 3. Those that contain a heavy preponderance of a liquid, such as water, to encourage mobility. Mankind assumes that life requires water, and they are not far from the truth. There are other substances, just as there are other substitutes for carbon in the chemical chains that form DNA. But the stage must be set for any type of complex life forms to develop for mobility. Thus, worlds such as your outer planets are too cold. Worlds such as your planet Venus are too hot. Worlds such as your planet Mars do contain enough water to support the development of life, which did develop, but has now been frozen out. Moons such as Europa could support life in slow motion that would scarcely develop. Gaseous planets such as Saturn or Jupiter could support life if the chemical mix is such that DNA-type structures can develop, the heavy atmosphere acting like a type of ocean. However, within your solar system, only the Earth currently supports complex life, with ample water and heat from a molten core and the right amount of sunlight from a moderate-sized sun. Both Mars and Venus and a number of planets formerly in the asteroid belt supported life in the past. The asteroid belt had water planets capable of developing complex life forms, but were dashed to pieces by the trash and moons that accompany the periodic passage of Planet X. Your gaseous planets have a chemical mix that aborts rather than supports the building of DNA-type structures. And Planet X, also a member of your solar system, has a slow and very controlled explosive process that supplies it with its own heat and light, which emerges through deep rifts in the ocean and scatters it in the atmosphere to form a diffuse light around this traveling planet. This is the end of the quote from Zeta Talk, Habitable Worlds, written February 15, 1997. I have been given what is called a life form orientation as a contactee. This was in preparation for my role as a communicator, what I'm doing now, being in the media and relaying my information on a website. The first lineup was a lineup of hominoids, not too much of a shock. Here's what I recorded as a result of that lineup, and this can be found in the Worlds section, Life Form Orientations, although it's clearly marked not Zeta Talk, but Nancy's Recall. Greek God. He was an example of the 8-foot-tall giants that live on Planet X and came to Earth to mine for gold when their planet was passing through. He made Arnold Schwarzenegger look like a 97-pound weakling. He was wearing a Roman legionnaire's outfit and was attractively proportioned. What a hunk! My comment to him was, "No wonder they thought you were gods." Chicken Man. He looked just like a flesh-colored chicken without feathers, but upon close examination, I saw there were toes on the feet and fingers on the end of the wing-like arms. There was no beak, just a pointed face. When I asked what his planet was like, I was given a telepathic view of a bleak, rocky place. I was told this was a female who was hugging and protective of the next hominoid, a male. Tiny Man. He stood about a foot tall and was flesh-colored with a rounded head and short limbs. He seemed terribly shy, and when spoken to would titter and look at the floor. Chicken Man did all the talking. Horned Toad Man. He was less than 4 foot tall and wore clothing. His skin was covered by large, humped plates similar in appearance to the top of a turtle shell, but with more flexibility. When asked, he explained that his home planet was a dry, rocky place. There were two of these, one smaller than the other, but I failed to ask if they were from different planets or were different sexes. Broomstick Man. Broomstick Man is a very tall and skinny alien from Close Encounters, the one with a small, thin head. He appeared to be in charge of presenting the hominoid lineup. He seemed responsible and sensitive to the varying discomforts and expectations of the group. Little Green Man. He was less than 4 foot tall, had a round green face but thin body, and splayed fingers from a small round hand. He wore a plain blue outfit. Slinky Man. He was short and appeared to have no neck, wrists, or ankles. All was one round tubular shape, like connected slinkies. He wore an outfit with a high collar, and his hair was clumped and still, black, standing straight up along the back of his head in peaks. I asked about his home planet, but received for an answer this movement. His right leg stretched out to twice its length, and landed to the side, then retracted and came back. He stretched like a slinky, without sign of bones inside. Persevering, I next got the following motion. His head rose up on a stretching neck, 2 feet above the shoulders. His neck didn't get thin, it just rose up like a slinky. Broomstick Man explained telepathically that I had offended Slinky Man, because I hadn't bowed before talking to him. I bowed deeply from the waist and begged his forgiveness, and got warm, happy vibes from Slinky Man telepathically. I never did get my question answered. I asked the Zetas about him afterwards, and they explained this race is from a planet similar to ours, not mature. Where we are violent, they get into a lot of posturing and political chits. The Zetas said, very tiring. Then there was Swamp Creature. Swamp Creature was presented later, after the presentation of hominoids, where the presentations were moving to other variations of intelligent creatures. He looked like a creature from the Black Lagoon, except that he was green, not black. A gentle giant, in and out of the water. End of the quote, from Life Form Orientations. Then we moved on to later presentations, getting progressively more shocking, and I continue quoting from what I'd written on Life Form Orientations. Vampire Man. Vampire Man looked like a hominoid flea. He stood 4 foot high with stubby little legs and arms and gray leathery skin. The outstanding feature was two long gray tusks coming down from his face about 4 inches apart. My understanding was that this was the equivalent of our vultures, in that it eats the dead by sucking fluids from a corpse. He seemed negative to me in that he wanted to intimidate, but like most bullies, backed away when really confronted. I grabbed the tusk and flipped him back onto his back. Not being agile, it took him some minutes to right himself, his stubby arms and legs flailing. Dino Man. Dino Man looked like a small Tyrannosaurus Rex, but was no taller than a large man. He was dark green with a ridge down his back and stood erect while leaning back on a large, fat tail used for balance. The end of this tail had a couple of pointed yellow barbs, which looked like fluid-filled and puffy. The mouth was lined with many teeth. He was not a telepathic conversationalist, except to insist that I was to obey him, a command he repeated several times. When this was refused, he opened his mouth to show all his teeth, leaning toward me. When he found he could not intimidate me, he lost interest and turned his back. Octopus Man. Octopus Man had a body and tentacles like an octopus. He was chocolate brown on the outside and cream-colored on the underside of his tentacles. I was delighted to find him very chatty. I asked what his home planet was like and was telepathically shown a planet of water with only an occasional rock sticking out, very windy above the waterline and inhospitable where the water was warm and inviting. We shook hands at the end, hand to tentacle. He had a special pink tentacle like a long earthworm that wrapped around my wrist to improve communications, it seemed. I had no problem with that. It's not the life form, it's the vibes coming from the soul within that matters. Beanbag Man. Introduction to this intelligent alien caused me to faint for the first time in my life. The Zetas dragged me to my feet and the introduction proceeded. Beanbag Man has two eyes and a broad round head and a single mouth. Asked what his home planet was like, I received a telepathic explanation of a green hothouse kind of place. Beanbag Man looked like a round green blob with no bones. When I asked what he ate, I got a telepathic view of a bug-like beetle being crushed. I gave Beanbag Man a telepathic view and explanation of our custom of shaking hands, and he extended one of about 50 little claws that fringed around his waist. After a moment's hesitation, I took and shook one of the claws. I asked about technology and didn't get anything back. He did not come for this visit on his own power. I asked about housing and got a telepathic scene of Beanbag Man sort of blowing along the ground toward a sheltered place along an embankment. Saying goodbye, Beanbag Man moved away from me, flowing along by heaving parts of his body forward or backward along the ground. Beanbag Man was all green except for his bottom where he abutted the ground. This was black. A pleasant fellow, meaning me no harm. Cockroach Man. Cockroach Man emerged from a blue-green pool where he had been floating face down. The pool appeared to be thick with algae. His back was smooth and rounded like a turtle shell, with no sign of wings, and he was gray all over. He stood erect on a rear set of legs, looking like a giant cockroach on the front, with several sets of arms and legs ending in two-toe finger combinations with a couple of round eyes at the head. He was not particularly communicative. Amoeba Man. Amoeba Man was light green and without form or distinction. He had no markings. He was on the floor and flowed around myself, around my ankles, so communication could occur. A picture of a rocky world where life only occurs in the crevice was relayed to me. Amoeba Man had to lay low to survive. End of the quotes from Life Form Orientations. The Zetas explained to me why many in the lineup seemed about the same size and shape. And I quote from Zeta Talk, size and shape. Where intelligent life forms come from all possible stops on the evolution scale, they are fairly consistent in size. The reason for this rule is simple. On the inevitable encounters, intimidation will be minimized. Thus, whether a life form is similar to an insect, octopus, snake, lizard, monkey, bird, or hominoid, they have all been genetically engineered to be of the same approximate size. Within these parameters, there is great variation on other facets, however, as the life form must live on the world they evolved on, and this cannot be ignored. Thus, on those worlds where the mass of the planet is such that gravity exerts a great pull, the life form will evolve with enough strength in bone and muscle to move about. Thus, the giant hominoids from Planet X are large, heavy-boned, and strong in comparison to humans, as their planet exerts almost twice as much gravity pull as the Earth. Thus we, the Zetas, are stronger than humans, as our planets also had more mass and resulting gravity pull. Where skinny, our bones are bolstered by wraparound ribs and joints that move in fewer directions than human joints, thus preventing strain. The evolution of a life form and the home planet determines to some degree where the life form can travel and work. Beyond the obvious differences in ability to tolerate high radiation from a hot sun, or the need to breathe air or water, or the base chemistry of the DNA, there are issues of gravity tolerance. Beyond approximate size, the life form may be carnivorous or vegetarian, or if the planet is lush with watery nutrients, even simply absorb nutrients through the skin, as many single-cell organisms do. They may have teeth or no teeth, eyes or no eyes, or multiple eyes, skin that is dry and tough or covered with slime or oil, bones as an interior or exterior skeleton or no bones at all, able to generate their own sugars as do plants or be completely dependent upon food located and eaten, breathing through lungs or gills or absorbing air or water components through the skin, covered with feathers or fur or scales or without an outer garment. Life forms come in all shapes, and humans embracing the awakening should be mentally and emotionally prepared to encounter them. Bear in mind that they think of humans as a strange form, too. And this is the end of the quote from Zeta Talk, Size and Shape, written August 15, 1996. It had taken me some time to come to grips with Cockroach Man, as that was a recall that I didn't want to recall. All those many legs waggling at me. And where I'd had telepathic communication with almost all the other life forms that I was presented with, nothing happened between me and Cockroach Man, and I presumed this was because our DNA was too different, preventing a shared communication of brainwave to brainwave compatibility that just wasn't there. The Zetas state that very few worlds have intelligent insects as the evolved species for a reason. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Intelligent Insects. On water planets where no dry land exists, the life form that emerges as the intelligent species is most often a type of octopus, as their tentacles allow manipulation of the environment and intelligence eventually develops due to that capacity. On planets where reptiles prospered well, where a rapid rotation of the planet toasts the environment evenly and allows cold-blooded reptiles to be constantly active, the reptiles simply eat the emerging mammals. On planets where a mammal life form emerges routinely have an environment that is harsh in some way to reptiles. Your Earth is such a planet, with a slow rotation that creates cold nights, winters, and poles such that cold-blooded reptiles are sluggish and slow. On planets where insects develop as the dominant intelligent species, the planet has land but does not have a generous food supply in its water or as vegetation on the land. Insects eat anything in tiny bites and can live on dung, rotting tissue, crumbs, and the slime that may cover rocks along the edge of water pools. In the case of planets where insects emerge as predominant, some insect forms begin to eat other insects and thus can grow larger. Humans, used to insect forms that are tiny, are seeing what occurs when all insect forms are consumed by others. On Earth, insects are consumed not only by other insects, but also are the favorite food of birds, reptiles, and rodents. For any insect to evolve as a large specimen on Earth would require a protected environment where none of the other Earth creatures could discover it. This is simply not the case on your Earth, but is the case on those rare worlds where insects evolve as the predominant and eventually the intelligent species. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Intelligent Insects, written December 15, 1996. Reptilians have the reputation of being cold-blooded and cruel. The souls incarnating into reptilian life forms are as likely to be empathetic and kind as humans. Cold-blooded does not necessarily mean cold-hearted. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Reptilians. We ourselves, the Zetas, have been described as lizards, where we do not have a genetic affinity for what Earthlings know to be lizards at all. Our genetics are similar to humans, from the same base, and we are warm-blooded. There are cold-hearted humans who are warm-blooded, and there are warm-hearted reptilians who are primarily cold-blooded. There are numerous reptilians at work in the vicinity of Earth. Some of the forms are hominoid or pure hominoid, with arms and hands with fingers and opposable thumbs, and legs and feet with toes. Eyes forward on the face rather than facing to the side, and a bipedal stance. Others take the form of what you would call snakes, with some development of limbs in varying numbers. Others have forms similar to lizards and walk on four or more legs, their bodies too stiff to allow a stance. These alien forms can rear up to perform functions, but essentially work at the floor level. A reptilian form familiar to humans is the dino. Were not as large as the Earth's dinosaurs, this reptilian looks like a miniature Tyrannosaurus rex and stands at least as tall as the average human. End of the quote from Zeta Talk Reptilians, written July 15, 1995. Indeed, the Zetas say that those operating in a service to self or self-focused environment, taken off to prison colonies and incarnating there into some life form, often these life forms are reptilian because there is less empathy in these life forms, animals, and therefore the self-centered soul feels more comfortable. They're not disturbed or interrupted by empathy, which they want nothing to do with. The praying mantis, considered by many to be an insect-looking alien, is in fact a hominoid, as are the cat people, who are also hominoids. Hominoids also come in many varieties, and I quote from Zeta Talk, Cat People. Humans think of hominoids as bipedal and hairless, the naked ape. Hominoid forms evolve naturally on many worlds, and just as the proto-hominoid on Earth was a hairy ape, the proto-hominoid elsewhere can take many forms. Due to the genetic engineering that takes place, grafting genetics from existing hominoid stock, the hominoid visitors that humans have encountered look similar to humans in the main, and thus have given the erroneous impression that this is the hominoid form. The naked ape is but one variation of the hominoid form. What is termed the praying mantis is a hominoid, and what many contactees take to be the insect forms of their visitors are almost invariably hominoid. There are alien hominoids that look like monkeys or apes to humans, and a variation on this form is a furry hominoid taken to be a bipedal cat. Humans have whiskers, but not the stiff sensing kind that rodents and their pet cats and dogs possess, so seeing whiskers on the delicate face of a fuzzy visitor has caused them to assume these visitors to be cat people. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Cat People, written May 15, 1996. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Praying Mantis. The praying mantis is large, dark, and to humans, insect-like. They have no physiological similarity to the insects of Earth, however, and in fact are a form of hominoid mammalian. The praying mantis are few in number, and they possess remarkable telepathic abilities. I quote from Zeta Talk, Green Men. Some aliens create chlorophyll in response to energy emitted from a sun and synthesize crude nutrients such as minerals and waters into sugars. This only goes so far and in fact only gives what you would describe as a sugar high, a boost. I quote from Zeta Talk, Many Grays. What does that mean, gray? That the skin tone is gray rather than green or blue or beige? Well, we've got news for the human race. Most of the alien forms that you will meet will be gray. Of the some thousands or more visitors on Earth, over half have been a gray tone. Why is this? The color is what the eye can perceive. Do you imagine that the human eye can see all? Your scientist will tell you this is not so, that your eyes see a very small spectrum of what is to be seen. When the color of the skin before you cannot be seen by you, you register gray. It is impossible to describe the color spectrum the humans are missing, as they would have no frame of reference. The colors are new to humans. The rainbows we see have dozens of colors beyond the rainbows you see. End of Zeta Talk, Many Grays. All of these were dated 1995. A number of hominoids visiting Earth look remarkably human, however. The Nordics, the Pleiadians, the Men in Black, visitors from Orion. Here's Zeta Talk on the Nordics, and I quote, "The Nordics have less patience with humans than other alien groups and expect humans to be pure of heart and have little conflict about their roles. The Nordics work at a high level towards solving the Earth's problems and feel they make the best use of their efforts in this way, and their track record reflects this. Zeta Talk on Pleiadians, and I quote, "Some Pleiadian genetics were utilized in the humankind's past during prior genetic engineering phases. The Pleiadians feel they are particularly adept at communicating the service to other philosophy to humans due to these genetic links, and have carved out this role for themselves. This is a worthy and time-consuming task, and one which they work at with great dedication. They are very active. They often touch people and communicate, being considered greeters, and are very social. The Pleiadians are a tiny proportion of the total visitors at present, less than 0.5%. Zeta Talk on Orion. Orion received bad press early on because of a much trumpeted visit to the United States government. The pendulant noses of these entities from Orion are a signal identifier." End of the quotes, all written in 1995. Well, where they look human, they are not among us living on Earth for a number of reasons. And here's a quote from Zeta Talk, Human Lookalikes. "There are currently no alien visitors that would be taken as human by other humans. The myth was spread by government disinformation agents as a means of raising paranoia in the populace. The distrust of aliens and their purported takeover agendas was to reach into every household, every family, and every bedroom. You too may be married to an alien. Movies were produced that showed humans being snatched and clones put in their place, and if not a replacement, then possessed by an alien soul or implanted with a control mechanism, all to raise the level of paranoia so that citizens could be expected to turn in their friends and neighbors if they mentioned having contact with aliens. There are no alien life forms living in human societies as human lookalikes or otherwise. It is frequently mentioned that the Pleiadians look very much like humans, as well as the Nordics and Syrians. Where the similarities immediately impress humans having contact with these hominoids, there are differences that would stand out should they simply set up housekeeping in the neighborhood. The eating habits would be the first to be noticed, as where genetic engineering of hominoids has resulted in similar looking forms, the worlds the hominoids had to adapt to differed greatly. Nordics eat little, having learned to adapt to lean times on their world. Faced with what humans consider a meal, a Nordic would appear a picky eater. Just as the men in black are under stress when exposed to the sun's rays, hominoid life forms from dim suns, such as ourselves, have difficulty dealing with a mid-sized sun such as yours. This would be true of Pleiadians as well as Nordics, who would simply not get sunburned, but would develop symptoms of radiation poisoning as well." End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Human Lookalikes, written October 15, 1996. Where they don't live among us, the men in black do live on Earth as our neighbors, as does Bigfoot and a reptilian species that lives in subterranean cavities. These are not alien visitors from another world, but transplants from another world. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Men in Black. "The men in black have received a lot of press as their visits are in the subconscious of humans. Where do they come from? They are not extraterrestrial at all, but live underground in tunnels and caverns. The men in black have constructed cities underground, structures with multiple stories and tram systems run by electricity, but these are in natural caverns and are not connected to one another unless natural passageways exist. The electrical energy the men in black use is chemically generated, a method learned on their home planet prior to their transplantation to Earth. Their electrical energy is not abundant and would hardly support the average United States homeowner with her many electrical appliances. If the men in black live in natural underground caverns, then how have they escaped the eyes of eager explorers who pass up no opportunity to discover new underground passageways and caverns? There are 1,000 times more caverns and passageways than man has come upon, or even suspects, many far deeper than man has even probed. The men in black, being unable to live on the surface, established themselves underground when they first arrived on Earth in a technologically advanced state. They are not violent, as humans are by nature, but they're scared silly of being discovered by humans. Being no less intelligent than humans, they have spent no small amount of time devising ways to keep from being discovered, like a rat in a hole with no back door. End of the quote from Men in Black, written July 15, 1995. Well, that accounts for the occasional report of men in black appearing at someone's door saying, "Don't look into this any further." They came up, made a nighttime visit, and went away again, doing their best to counter-intimidate. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Bigfoot. "Bigfoot has fascinated mankind for as long as the two races have been in contact with each other, as infrequent and fleeting as that may be. The reason for this has less to do with Bigfoot's size and ape-like appearance, which would be understandable on this earth, as with Bigfoot's elusiveness. Gorillas, for instance, are as large, and chimpanzees seem as intelligent, so why is Bigfoot a fascination? The answer lies in his seemingly uncanny ability to elude detection. The reason for this is that Bigfoot was to house a group of souls who are in quarantine. They remain elusive because they are not to intermingle with mankind. In this effort, they do not go unassisted. Bigfoot is there right under your nose. Why are they in quarantine? These souls have been placed into a primitive condition at their request so that they can return to a basic understanding of how to get along with each other, with nature, and ponder the wondrous workings of nature. Their quarantine is not an exile. It is a search for peace." End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Bigfoot, written July 15, 1995. And what about that subterranean species, reptilian, intelligent species, as intelligent as ourselves, that we're unaware of? And I quote from Zeta Talk, Subterranean Life. "Little known is that a reptilian race lives underground in the caverns and waterways that occur naturally. This reptilian race, if seen by humans, would not be recognized as an intelligent species, as they carry none of the trappings of civilization. Do they have technology, structures, computers? Yes and no. Where their IQ is less than humans and they are not as dexterous nor upright, they nonetheless can manipulate their surroundings. Socially, their existence is not that much different from humans. They both care for and murder each other. We will not mention their form nor the location of their homes, as they would be vulnerable should humans go hunting for them, for sport, as those inclined toward power trips surely would. These transplants to the earth came from worlds that could no longer support them. The men in black cannot tolerate life on the surface. They were used to dim light. The men in black, in fact, are not even biologically compatible with humans to the degree that offspring might be possible. The reptilian race developed on a water planet. They also suffered from a dying sun and were used to cold, dark conditions before they were transplanted." End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Subterranean Life, written August 15, 1995. Creatures that look and act like intelligent alien species but are no more intelligent than dogs or cattle can also be aliens. Well, why is this so? As our Earth is a kindergarten schoolhouse for emerging souls, where we learn to either care for each other empathetically or remain self-focused, the battle of good or evil, essentially, our alien contacts are attempting to convince us to go in one of these two directions. 95% of the souls that emerge around the universe turn to the empathetic, practicing golden rule orientation. 5% remain immature, self-focused like a baby, many of them becoming bullies or sadists, very control-oriented, and they are living in prison colonies. But they're, both these groups are allowed to come to Earth and counsel us if we are in a mood to call and be seeking advice from elsewhere, whether we voice this deliberately or just kind of wish it. That's called giving the call to aliens, and they can then make contact with us, which is how contact starts. Where aliens advising the good path want to increase empathy, aliens advising the bad path want to increase fear and terror, as this increases self-focus. They're looking for more numbers, people to come in underneath them so they can like rise up in the hierarchy. So they're looking to recruit people, and by increasing fear and terror, they increase the likelihood that humans here on Earth will turn to the self-focused orientation, remain immature, not grow into empathy. Well, just yell fire in a crowded theater and see how many people get trampled. That's everyone thinking for themselves. That's what fear and terror do. So these aliens, wanting to increase their numbers, wanting new converts, wanting to increase fear and terror among humans, are searching for a way to do this. By the rules, they can give us counseling, psychological input, get us to do things one way or another, like backstab our neighbor or cheat or however, you know, the benefit of being self-focused, not an uncommon concept on our Earth if one looks at Wall Street, for instance. But they can only go so far with this kind of psychological counseling. So how do they accomplish their goals? Well, vampires, dragons, Mothman, and the recent chupacabras are not intelligent creatures from other worlds. They're like dog packs, and they're brought to Earth to terrify and frighten humans. The rules are different, though, for alien dog packs and the dog packs we have naturally on Earth, like wolves and bears and warthogs or whatever humans might worry about encountering. By the rules, these dog packs can only affect humans if the human submits to the intimidation, basically gives up and says, "All right, I'm yours, you've got me. You've overpowered me, I have no pushback, there's nothing I can do." Then the alien dog pack can savage, eat them, or however, which is why we had vampire bats sucking blood from people in the past, dragons eating people in the past. If the human gives up and submits to this intimidation, then it's considered like a similar situation to being attacked by wolves or a rabid dog or by a bear or something. It's things that happen on our own Earth and are natural to our Earth. But if the human stands firm and doesn't give in to this fear or terror, then the alien dog packs are held back and they can't hurt the human. Because these alien dog packs are on a type of leash. Well, this line is drawn because obviously these visitors from what's essentially a prison colony planet, you know, where they don't care a whit about each other and they just, you know, beat on each other until the pecking order is established. They're looking for new converts. Well, looking for new recruits, why don't they just flood the Earth then with a dragon in every street and a vampire in every attic? The reason for this is somebody has to be holding the leash on that dog. And this takes up manpower, so to speak. The foot soldiers, the minions from the prison colonies have to be busy holding these dogs in check by the rules. If they don't do that, if they break the rules, boom, they're gone from the environment of Earth, and then they have no psychological influence over how the emerging souls on Earth might choose to go, you know, self-focused or empathetic, etc. Well, if the campaign doesn't seem to be working, doesn't seem to be bringing in a lot of recruits, then it's a lost cause, and everybody goes away, including the dog packs. And that's what happened with the dragons in the past, happened with the vampires, and it recently happened with the chupacabras also. They were removed. In the words of the Vedas, then, regarding these dog packs, as with dog packs, they are allowed to encounter, terrify, and even kill humans should the humans basically give up and submit. Thus, there are stories of dragons consuming virgins, vampires biting to death victims virtually drained of blood, end quote. So that if the vast majority of intelligent species in the universe are not hominoid, and given that the Earth is a very busy place right now during its awakening to the alien presence, do contactees invariably get contacted by hominoids, or are there some surprises? I quote from Zeta Talk, "Ugly Aliens." Humans instinctively avoid food that is rotten and are attracted to food that smells fresh. Men see beauty in women who have full hips, slender waists, and ample bosoms, all traits that indicate the ability and readiness to bear young. Both sexes find a diseased partner unattractive, a safeguard against spreading infections or perpetuating genetic diseases. A life form that looks like a slime-covered horned toad or an amphibious octopus is not a life form humans would instinctively cuddle up to. Humans, due to their evolutionary roots, are inclined to think about dinner or avoidance when encountering such creatures, not about communication. The global shift in thinking that humans make when realizing that they are not alone as an intelligent species includes contemplating what this means. It does not mean sitting around a table chatting with other very human-looking aliens, an image the media has portrayed. Humans should bear in mind, when making these adjustments, that their appearance may be just as disgusting to the visitors. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, "Ugly Aliens," written May 15, 1996. The dominant species on a planet might be something that humans would consider a meal, or vice versa. Perhaps the visitor would consider humans a meal. This type of conflict for those species that are predators, eating other life forms in any manner, is a conflict that ultimately encourages empathy, according to the Vedas. This is not unlike the conflict that many humans on Earth have and resolved by becoming vegetarians, an attempt to step in the right direction. And I quote from Zeta Talk, "Intelligent Carnivores." It may be argued that plants and single-cell creatures live by absorbing only chemicals and light and thus sustain themselves in a benign manner. But those close examinations prove otherwise. Bacteria or virus material considered on the borderline of being living material infects and destroys that which they need for nourishment, and the amoeba and protozoa likewise surround and consume foodstuffs they encounter, whether this food be living or not. Plants seem to take up carbon dioxide and light and transform this into sugar. Yet the roots of the plant draw up the nourishment the plants need only because they are embedded in soil moistened in the byproduct of other life, which must die for the plant to grow. And some carnivorous plants don't wait for the donor to die. Eating one another starts early. Carnivorous behavior is intrinsic to corporal life. Why God so structured the world in this way is not known, but considering that all young souls begin their life incarnated, there are certain lessons that are guaranteed. As empathy in some degree is also intrinsic to corporal life, a conflict between the self and the other is a given. Thus, the conscious decision to sacrifice the self is frequently made, and this is the spark that begins development toward empathy. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, "Intelligent Carnivores," written July 15, 1996. During the pole shift, when 90% of the Earth's population is expected to die, either as a result of the shift itself or more likely, disease and starvation afterwards, there's going to be a lot of souls looking to reincarnate into new bodies. Well, where do they go? Earth is scheduled during this transformative period for Earth to be a home for the good-hearted, the service to others, those who are practicing the golden rule and have been for many lifetimes. that 5% that have refused to grow up and mature, the self-focus, the service to self, off to the prison colonies with them. Well, about 30% of humans, the souls that have evolved on Earth, are service to other, meaning they will be allowed to reincarnate on Earth as Zeta-human hybrids and the like. So what about the other 65%? Well, they're off to a different world, described by the Zetas here in Zeta Talk, Next Stop. It is a water world with scarcely a rock or two jutting above the surface of the endless waves. The species on this planet have all evolved from life forms that spend their entire life in the water. Thus, no mammals exist on this planet, since a stint on land, such as occurred in the past for your whales and dolphins, was not possible during their evolutionary past. This world has received transplants from other worlds frequently, so there's a broad spectrum of past experiences in the memory of those incarnating there. Humans reincarnating there will find they quickly adjust to living on a water world, having tentacles instead of hands, and tending the occasional batch of eggs. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Next Stop, written July 15, 1997. So where does that leave us in answering Roger's questions about more specifics about the future water world that most humans on Earth will find themselves reincarnating into? I quote from New Zeta Talk, written to address Roger's question. Humans, being land-based animals with hands and digits that can manipulate their environment, cannot imagine being an intelligent creature in a water world. Fins? Tentacles? How does one work a keyboard or accumulate a 401k or conduct the equivalent of dentistry as a water creature? Modern civilization has as one of its driving engines electricity, which surely would not work in the water world unless mass suicide were desired. Does knowledge about their history get passed down to the young by the fishy equivalent of word of mouth as legends? If they have the equivalent of the written word, what is the tablet? And more importantly, what holds the pen? Issues of warfare do not seem so unimaginable, as mankind has scarcely stepped away from the fistfight as automatic response, and all animals have some sort of defense mechanism, be it fight or flight. Spiritual growth or spiritual interaction does not require the trappings of modern civilization: electricity, long-distance communication, and dentures. Spiritual growth was ongoing during the days of the caveman and proceeds today in third world countries where life is scarcely better. In trying to project what life might be like in a water world, man should not assume that light is a necessity, or even eyes. It has been documented that some blind men can read printed words through their skin, sensing some difference in the light emitted. Telepathy, a sixth sense, is used in the animal kingdom extensively, a method by which mothers communicate to their young, the herd or flock communicates with its members, and mating pairs find each other. For spiritual growth, what is needed is for the incarnated creature to be able to interact with each other, to enable another's life, improve it out of caring, or conversely to punish, intimidate, or starve another out of concern only for the self. Guns and knives and the oppression of debt are not needed to enable or express a service to self orientation. In a water world, snatching food from the weaker, blocking the way so that escape from a threatening situation is delayed, are all tools by which the selfish can demonstrate, by their actions, their chosen orientation. Likewise, opportunities to care for one another are available to every species. High-tech? Is electricity the only medium by which a creature becomes high-tech? We have stated that crop circles are laid by water creatures, their only opportunity to participate. Crop circles are made by a ray which incites a growth hormone in the crop, combined with wind action caused by changes in the air over the spot to be swirled. Particle movement is not incited simply by the press of electrons. In man's world, heat, light, and electrons seem to go together, but those seeing crop circles laid down have not reported that either heat or light are a necessary component. Perhaps, in their water world, they have identified particles to be manipulated that mankind has not yet dreamed exist. Even sound waves, which utilize anything physical around them to be transmitted, can travel long distances through oceans, being one of the means by which whale pods communicate with each other. If man needs phones or carrier pigeons, whales do not. Status within a society, rules and laws, can certainly be enacted in a water world. The dolphin has been noted to swarm to protect their young, or even a hapless human swimmer, from danger or attack. What message goes out to the group that their help is required? Is this not a societal expectation known to all? The rules are not written on paper for the dolphin. They are written in the creature, passed down by interaction, old to young, and are kept simple, devoid of pedantic qualifiers for that reason. Is this not a better system than the contorted system that man has developed? End of the News Zeta talk in response to Roger's question. Well, Roger, did that Zeta talk answer your questions?
How big is their planet compared to Earth's? How deep is the water on their planet? How far away in terms of light years is their planet? What is the population of their planet? Does their planet have natural disasters like earthquakes and volcanoes? How long is their day or their year? Is there only one species of octopus on their planet, or several, like our different races of mankind, for instance, here on Earth? What is a typical day like? Do they forage for food and then sleep? Do they have entertainment? How do they treat their dead? Do they have burial customs? Do they worship a god? Do they have religion? I take it that they are blind and sense each other telepathically. Do they have an emotional range like our human one? Are they as capable of experiencing as wide a range of emotional feelings as humans do? How large physically are the octopi? Do the males physically dominate the females, or vice versa? Is their sex drive as intense as humans? Or do they have mating seasons and mate for life? Do they lay eggs or give live birth? How long is a typical lifespan? Is it 30 years, 70 years? Do they have the equivalent of a Hitler or a Stalin? Do they have mass genocide? How socially organized are they? Do they have marriages or families, schools, courts of law, or prison systems? Do they migrate like Bedouins in small tribes, or do they stay in one place? And do they cultivate their own food, or are they all predators? What do they eat, or are they themselves prey to other predators?
The answers raised more questions, which is typical of complex issues. That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought, those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.
You have been listening to a Blog In Broadcasting service, a service to others' endeavor. Thank you very much, and good night.